This is a show about peace, preserving it, promoting it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Recently, KPFK correspondent Sonali Kolhatkar interviewed two youth at the end of the Not in Our Name peace rally in Los Angeles. The two youth had participated in the burning of an American flag. Here's the story following the incident.
Can you just describe what you just did?
We just burned an American flag.
And why did you do that?
Excuse me?
Why did you do that?
We burned the flag simply because it's a symbolic act. We can't take arms. We can't go into the front and tell the troops not to fight. We can't go and face the Afghan people, the people in Iraq, and say that it's not us that's fighting that war. The only thing we can do is stay here and protest and rally and burn a flag and say we're not for this war. We're not for this regime. We're not putting a flag in our card and supporting everything our government says. That's the only reason we're burning. Because we can't take up arms and go fight at the front. We're stuck here.
Before this flag was burned, it said, "Know your symbols." I just wanted to express that the American flag is a symbol. People have been taking it highly seriously after 9/11, and it's kind of ridiculous. People don't actually realize what else it stands for, as opposed to justice and liberty and lies.
Can I ask you how old you are?
I'm 18.
20.
And how would you describe yourself? A lot of times we don't get voices of people of color on the mainstream media who are expressing themselves against the war. Do you have any comments on that?
It's simply because they don't want other voices to be heard. It's simply because there's other views of things that, you know, don't go with the trend, don't go with the flow. And talk about dissent, you know. And the media doesn't want dissent to be public. They want to manufacture a consent. They want people to follow suit to an order. They want people to think they're free and acting freely, but truly they're acting on an order that's being bombarded to them by the media. So that's the only reason we don't hear any other voices. They want to manufacture a consent. They want people to think they're thinking freely, but they truly are not. That's the sole reason why voices aren't heard.
There have been a lot of accusations over the past several months that those who don't support the Bush administration's war on terrorism are unpatriotic or somehow un-American. We thought we'd take a few minutes on today's show to examine just what the notion of patriotism means. Here's a speech author and media critic Michael Parente gave in Boulder, Colorado.
Well, as a guest on radio talk shows, I have on a number of occasions criticized U.S. foreign policy, and one time an irate caller called in and he said to me, do you love your country? And the question was obviously rhetorical, because here was someone who saw fit to question my patriotism because I was questioning the policies of our leaders. That's really strange when you think about it. The caller was manifesting a symptom of what might be called super patriotism, also sometimes called stupor patriotism, also called pseudo-patriotism, a phenomenon best defined as the willingness to follow our leaders uncritically in all their dealings with other nations, especially when those dealings are confrontational and belligerent and they involve a question of national pride or the use of military force. That's the definition of super-patriotism. So I asked myself, what do you mean by country? Do they love every region and locale in the United States? Well, obviously, very few of us have been to every region and locale, and nor would all of us find all the regions and locales all that lovable. Does love of country mean loving the American people? Well, again, even the most gregarious among us have met only a relatively small portion of the American people. Do super patriots love America for its history and culture? Again, I'm really skeptical of that because it's my impression that they know very little about American history and culture, or rather, much of it is rather unappreciated by them. Furthermore, there's a terrible side to our history that's really not all that lovable. For instance, the extermination of Native American Indian nations, the enslavement of African people, the aggressive wars against Vietnam, Mexico, Central America, the Philippines, and elsewhere. Well, the America that the super patriots claim to love is neither a geographical totality, nor is it a vast population, nor is it really a history or culture. As far as I can see, their America, and they say love America, is an ideological abstraction. It's an emotive symbol that can be embodied in other abstract symbols like the flag. It's sort of almost a love without content. And how else can you love a flag? I mean, a flag, as you know, is a piece of rag on a stick. And it's got colors and things. Well, having said that, let me contradict myself. Because there is one real content to the super patriotism. Its main substance is militarism. Indeed, the most militaristic among us seem to think that they are the most patriotic. Isn't that rather extraordinary? Our history's patriotic vignettes are usually military ones. Valley Forge, the Alamo, Gettysburg, the battleship Maine, Pearl Harbor, raising the flag on Iwo Jima, D-Day, the MIAs and POWs, and the like. The commemorations of our national leaders during national holidays would be incomplete without the marching troops, the weapon displays, martial music. I remember once sitting in Urbana, Illinois, July 4th, watching this parade come by, and on this float was suddenly this missile, sort of small missile, but there was this instrument of death on this float that was going by, and there were some people around me, and you know what they did? They started to applaud this inanimate object. I mean, there wasn't even a pilot or, you know, somebody else tending to it, or a soldier striding it and waving and going, "Yow, look at me," you know. This was at a time when these things were being used in Vietnam. Now, the way super patriots express their national pride leaves me uncomfortable. It seems the love we are to have for our country rests on some kind of competition with other countries, that it comes at an expense with other countries. It's a love that is predicated on some invidious comparison to other countries being lesser, being not as good. This, by the way, we might recognize immediately as the being number one syndrome. I guess I must have heard about being number one for a long time, but the first time it ever stuck in my mind was when I heard President Richard Nixon sometime in the late 60s announce, and I quote, "America is still number one." And the "still," of course, you know, hints at some anxiety that there might be some slippage there. So I said, all right, we're number one. And then one of those troublesome questions came again in my head, and I said, if we're number one, what are we number one in? I mean, what are you number one in? So I thought, I said, population? And then, no, the Chinese walk away with all the awards in that category. Geography? No, I think the Soviets and even Canada has more real estate than we do. We're not number one in size. I mean, Brazil is a number of countries, I think. I don't even want to think about it, about all the countries that might be ahead of us there. Steel production and other basic industries? I perked up a little. Well, we used to be number one in that, but we have slipped down the list because our super patriot corporate leaders have taken to abandoning our communities and exporting our jobs and bringing the factories off to Taiwan and Argentina and South Korea, where they can work for slave labor wages. Which, when you think about it, is not the way for super patriots to act, really, you know, take our factories away and all that. So I said, well, what are we number one? Are we number one in cuisine? Please, please. I mean, in that category, we are strictly double digits. So the question remains, I was sitting there saying, well, what are we number one in? You know? And the best I can tell from the super patriotic utterances is that it gets down to two things. One, wealth. With no concern as to how the wealth is distributed and how it's used and for what effects. And military power. With no concern again with how that military power is used and for whose interests that it might serve at home and abroad. Now, supposedly we can love America and be proud of our country because it's so great. The implication is, however, that if it weren't so great, it wouldn't be so lovable. And that began to trouble me. The super patriot's love of country seems predicated on the country's being up there, stronger and superior to other countries. What about people from lesser lands, as we might call them? And what about somebody from Luxembourg I said, what does someone from Luxembourg do? They go around shamefaced like this, you know? They say, you from Luxembourg? You from Luxembourg? I said, no, I'm French.
Author and media critic Michael Parente speaking on super patriotism and the need to be number one. Thanks to Lynn Gary and Sally Soriano for that piece. People around the U.S. have been joining the chorus of voices saying no to war. While anti-war sentiment still receives cursory mention in the corporate press, various studies since 9/11 have shown that women are barely being heard, with 10 men to every one woman guest on the major networks. At Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, women gathered this week to speak, sing, and vision their desires for peace. Deepa Fernandez prepared this report.
I spent this morning wondering what to do, where to go, move to, leave this place, disillusioned, jaded, thinking to myself, not again, not again, not again will I walk through my neighborhood parking lot to view the bright yellow bumper sticker on a classmate's car. Black letters, bold type, all caps. Nuke, Iraq.
Well, we mom, we fight for freedom. We're strong, we fight for peace. We struggle every day to prove our worth. Well, we're men and we're proud to say what we are in ourselves. We've been hiding in the background far too long.
Well, traditionally, women's identity during times of war has sort of been distorted or put out as caregivers. We were forced to, during World War One and World War Two, to stay back, take care of the kids, or give care to the soldiers and things like that. Again, sort of being used as commodities. But during the bombings of Afghanistan, especially this new war on terror, this concept of feminism has been distorted where, you know, CNN played Behind the Veil back to back over like 10 times right after September 11th, sort of justifying U.S. bombings in Afghanistan as sort of going in and liberating the women of Afghanistan, not realizing that the soldiers who are coming from this country, who have a history of sexism, are going to go into Afghanistan and liberate the women of Afghanistan. There's definitely some kind of discrepancy there. And also the feminists in this country were supporting U.S. troops in Afghanistan, saying that we need to be in there to liberate the women of Afghanistan. Again, such a false sense of where feminists and feminism comes from. I mean, if we think that men in this country are not treating us equally, why do we expect them to go into Afghanistan, go into the global south, and treat the women there equally?
With my sister beside me, I am strong, I am free when she's with me. Yeah.
With their children, with their whatever belongings they could take, about 40 of them left and settled in this village with a total population now of 75, including them. And one night on October 22nd, it was about 11:30 at night. They had just put their children to bed. They realized that they were being attacked. They heard a loud noise. One of my cousins went to the doorway to see what was happening. There were no windows in this place. It was an adobe, you know, like hut they were living in. And she saw a motorcycle on fire, and she screamed. And just as she screamed, the children explained this to me. They saw her, she was 5 months pregnant, they saw her severed in half by something that hit her in the doorway. And they realized that they had to get out of there.
Over the past 100 years, the death rate of women in war has risen drastically because civilians are the ones that are being killed. It's growing rapidly.
Feeling slightly ill, I awoke and checked my email and saw the headline I had been dreading, the one that took me back 10 years. We had been celebrating my best friend's birthday. We came home. We rang the doorbell. Her mother opened the door with tears in her eyes. She was crying and she was saying, and I can't remember now if she said, "We invaded? Bush invaded? They invaded."
They say united we stand, together we stand.
You
in mainstream media, women are so invisible in terms of their voices, our voices, that that it really distorts public opinion, it distorts public debate, and it distorts the functioning of a democracy.
We do have opposition mounting, and I've seen, for example, that women are being sidelined even within the opposition. The Nation magazine last week ran two articles in which it repeatedly identified the leaders of the opposition as Denis Kucinich and two other men. Now, in fact, a woman of color, Barbara Lee, was actually the leader of the opposition. She was the single woman who stood up and refused to vote for the resolution to attack Afghanistan. And certainly Cynthia McKinney is a great leader in opposition to the war. In neither of these articles about the leadership against the war were they even mentioned. And Barbara Lee is the author of a resolution now before Congress that about 20 Congress members have co-sponsored, including Denis Kucinich, a co-sponsor, but he is presented as the leader. Now, no doubt within Congress, the old boys network does make him more visible in a certain respect. But to set the record as if Barbara Lee and her resolution and Cynthia McKinney are not there is totally misrepresenting what's going on.
But the problem with mainstream media is that we consider these issues as either universal, i.e. male, terrorism, war, economics, etc., as if women are not invested in those subjects, or feminine, not fringe issues like how we take care of our children in this culture.
Another round of bombs are being loosely recorded in the press. Yes, again, yes, again, yes, again, and again, and again. I skipped classes, called my friends, left messages on their people's answering machines with the simple words, "I am sad today."
And I work with different organizations, and I see that most people who are standing for change are women, you know, and that's a really important thing. And, you know, a lot of times when there's so much oppression, and it takes so much courage and strength to fight that oppression and say no to something like something huge like this, and it goes beyond just your own oppression, but oppression like all around the world.
Build our own changes, of that you can be sure. The time has come for you to come out from behind that door. Open your mind.
Put my sister beside me.
Women Wait, Speak Out. Religious and civil rights leaders gathered this week at New York's historic Riverside Church to weigh in against a war in Iraq. WBAI's Robert Knight has more.
It was in New York's Riverside Church that Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. launched an ecumenical movement against the undeclared war in Vietnam 35 years ago, when he linked the peace and civil rights movements with his historic speech, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence.
As I ponder the madness of Vietnam and search within myself for ways to understand and respond in compassion, my mind goes constantly to the people of that peninsula. I speak not now of the soldiers of each side, but simply of the people who have been under the curse of war for almost three continuous decades now. I think of them, too, because it is clear to me that there will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cry.
King's anti-war mobilization was renewed this week when religious leaders gathered once more down by Riverside Church to oppose the new war against Iraq. Convener and Center for Constitutional Rights Director Ron Daniels framed the issue in the cavernous halls of the historic church.
We believe that the new post-war Cold War doctrine, the preemptive strikes, which the president is using as the rationale to attack a sovereign nation and forcibly achieve a regime change, is not only unconscionable, but a violation of international law.
The Riverside Conference coincided with published reports that, despite President Bush's claims of Iraq violating 12 Security Council resolutions, Iraq is by no means the world's greatest resolution violator, trailing behind Israel with 32, Turkey with 24, and Morocco with 17. According to San Francisco University professor Stephen Zunas, most UN violators are American allies, a point addressed by potential presidential candidate, the Reverend Al Sharpton.
Around the world with weapons of mass destruction, that we're not on our way into invading or having military action against. I remember when apartheid South Africa had weapons of mass destruction. We did not hear voices of this world say we've got to go and make sure they don't have those weapons. I remember as a child growing up in New York, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and President Kennedy put out the photos of the missiles in Cuba. We are saying that in 60, we were more prepared to make our case than we are in 2002. Either we are not technologically advanced, or either there are no photos to show, Mr. Bush. Maybe this is more about oil interests than freedom. And then even the CIA suggested yesterday that if you corner a man that can hurt, maybe you are risking more lives because you give him no choice but to release whatever he has that could add to mass destruction. I say we must resist. We must build a resistance movement. We must use everything possible in the nonviolent tradition of protest to stop this war. Some of us may have to spend nights in jail to make sure others don't spend days in graves. It seems the Democrats in the Congress have a case of political longevity. And as in the past, in history, moral leaders must come forward and stand for what is right. We learned from our fathers who stopped the Vietnam War in the 60s. We learned from our mothers who created the civil rights movement in the 60s. This must be a new era and a new generation. The comfort we had is we beat the fathers of George Bush. We can beat George Bush.
Among some of the nation's Christian communities, there is a growing mobilization and debate on the war in Iraq, with the 50-million-member National Council of Churches opposing a preemptive strike, while the more conservative Southern Baptist Convention has expressed support for an invasion following a June address by President Bush. Meanwhile, Martin Luther King III of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference reflected on the peace initiative his father launched at Riverside 3.5 decades ago.
My father shocked the world when he said 35 years ago, America is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. We must sadly admit that 35 years later, we still believe the answer to the problem of world conflict is to break UN Charter Article 2 and Article 51, which prohibits one nation from attacking another, except in self-defense. Are we going to stand silently on the sidelines as our administration moves us closer to war and closer to 9/11s around the world? Or was Ben Franklin right when he said that those who give up freedom for security deserve neither? Or maybe the voice of former President Dwight Eisenhower, beware of the military-industrial complex, should be ringing in our ear as Democrats join Republicans in marching us to war. Just maybe my father was right. War is poor chisel carved out of peaceful tomorrows.
Martin Luther King III at Riverside Church. In New York, I'm Robert Knight.
Freelance political analyst and commentator A.C. Byrd compares the current Bush administration's vision of the world to that of the Roman Empire.
The Iraqi War Storm, what it means for the American people. Greetings, I am A.C. Byrd, political analyst and commentator. The Bush administration is play-acting, using the Roman Empire's ancient strategy doctrine of imposing dictatorship at home and abroad, a strategy based upon brute force and plunder. It is a two-front war strategy, one against Iraq and the other against the American people, imposing a dictatorship at home and abroad, establishing an emperor reign at the White House, where he can summarily issue decrees that must be followed by over 180 nations, assembly that makes up the United Nations. The world body of nation that was born out of the ashes of World War II, a war that humankind witnessed the death of over 51 million human lives and the destruction of untold assets and economic and cultural losses. The horror borne by humankind compelled the world to establish the United Nations as an anti-war organization. This historic triumph for the world's people is being ignored by Emperor Bush and his palace advisors. Here at home, he has ordered his Attorney General Ashcroft to suppress and abandon guaranteed constitutional rights belonging to all Americans by their birthright and sovereign rights of citizenship. The First Amendment rights to free speech and the right of assembly is under fierce attack. The so-called USA Patriotic Act, rammed it through Congress, gave the executive branch expanded powers to invade the privacy of the American people. These draconian tactics unleashed a major strike into the heart of our U.S. constitutional democracy, destabilizing both the structure and vital consensus necessary to foster a healthy democracy between the peoples of the United States. Emperor Bush's war storm represents a threat to the national security of the American people. The obstruction of civil liberties, the downturn in the U.S. economy, followed by a lack of confidence in the economic policies created by instability and anxiety among the people of the United States. One cannot enforce an ancient Roman Empire doctrine, as Mr. Bush is doing, without imposing a doctrine of force and anti-democratic measures at home and abroad. America stands at a crossroad. Our constitutional democracy and our national security is threatened, not by Iraq, not by the Middle East, but right here at home. We must reject the self-declared play-acting strategy of Emperor George W. Bush and his palace minions, Monsieur Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Madam Rice. The accumulation of oil and power is their goal, not for America, but rather to the financial oligarchies that dominate the political economy of the world body of nation, a small core of financial elites who own and direct corporate power throughout the world, whose loyalty is not to the American people nor to any nation, an elite that is not bound by morality, ethics, religion, or belief in God or any findings of science. Their only motivation is by their god of profit and power. We, the people of the United States and the world at large, must mount an unrelenting struggle to reject the play-acting strategies directed against ourselves and the imposition of dictatorships established by oil monopolies and their minions in the White House and No. 10 Downing Street in London.
Political analyst A.C. Byrd. You've been listening to Imperatives for Peace, Pacifica's Peace Watch. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Tonight's engineer was Rolando Arrieta. Our editor is Reem Kathuda at WPFW. Our associate producers are Fidel Rodriguez of KPFK, Renee Feltz of KPFT, and Robert Knight of WBAI. Sam Husseini and Larry Bensky are consultants to the program. We had production assistance from Deborah Klaber at WBAI, Sidrak Franklin and Laurel Paget-Seekins at WPFW, Christopher Sprinkle of KPFK, David Russo of the DC Indie Media Center, and Eddie Becker. Our webmaster is Pete Caracas. For copies of Peace Watch, go to www.pacificaarchives.org. That's www.pacificaarchives.org. Or call 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your feedback on the show. Send us your comments to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening. Thank you.